its attention.
"Looks like the wolf has found himself a tender morsel tonight," he said, his voice magnified by speakers somewhere overhead. A second man stood on the stage behind him, leering at Scarlet. He was twice the size and a foot taller than the one who had spoken, and entirely bald. His hair had been replaced with two rows of bear's teeth implanted like gaping jaws into his scalp.
"Think I'll be taking that one home after I've destroyed Dog Boy's pretty face."
The audience laughed at the taunts, making catcalls and whistling to one another. Someone nearby asked Wolf if he was afraid to test his luck. Unruffled, Wolf turned back to Scarlet.
"He's undefeated," he said in an explanatory tone. "But so am I."
Annoyed that he could think for a second she cared, Scarlet sucked in a furious breath.
"I already calmed the police, and they'll be here any minute. If you just tell me where my grandmother is, you can leave. You can even warn your friends if you want. I won't shoot you, and I won't tell the police about you. Just tell me where she is, please."
He peered down at her, calm despite the growing rowdiness of the crowd. They'd started chanting something, the words muffled by the blood flowing through Scarlet's ears. She thought for a second he was crumbling. He was going to tell her, and she would keep her word long enough to find her grandma and get her away from these monsters who had taken her. Then she would have his head. Once her grandma was safe at home, she would track him down, and whoever else had helped him, and make them pay for what they'd done. Perhaps he noticed the darkening bitterness on her face, because he reached for her hand and gently pried up her fingers. On gut instinct, she dug the gun into his ribs, though she knew she wasn't going to shoot, not without answers. He didn't seem worried. Maybe he knew it, too.
"I believe your father did see a tattoo like mine."
His head dipped toward her.
"But it wasn't me."
He pulled away. Scarlet dropped her arm, letting the gun hang limp at her side, and watched the chanting crowd part for him. The onlookers were intimidated, but also amused. Most were smiling and jostling one another. Some were moving through the crowds, scanning wrists, collecting bids. He may have been undefeated, but it seemed clear that most bets had been placed on his opponent. She squeezed the gun until the textured metal of the handle left an imprint on her palm.
A tattoo like mine. What had he meant by that?
He'd only been trying to confuse her, she determined as Wolf launched himself over the stage's ropes, agile as an acrobat. The coincidence was too much. No matter. She'd given him a chance, but the police would be here soon and take him into custody. She would get her answers, one way or the other. Shaking with frustration, she tucked the gun back into her waistband. The thrumming in her temples was beginning to mellow, and she could make out the crowds chanting now.
"Hunter! Hunter! Hunter!"
Dizzy from the heat and rush of adrenaline, she glanced toward the building's enormous opening, where she could see overgrown weeds and wheat stalks lit by the moon. She noticed a woman with close-cropped hair glaring at her like a jealous girlfriend. Scarlet returned the look before shifting her attention to the stage. Lingering at the back of the crowd, she pulled up her hood again, drawing her face beneath its shadows. The crowd surged forward, carrying Scarlet closer to the fight. Hunter had ripped off his shirt, displaying a mass of raw muscle as he rattled the crowd. The row of teeth embedded on his head glinted as he bowled from one side of the stage to the other. Wolf was tall, but he looked like a child next to Hunter. Nevertheless, he was all composure in his corner of the platform, radiating arrogance with one foot up on the ropes, practically lounging. Hunter ignored him, pacing back and forth like a caged animal, growling, cursing, working the crowd into a frenzy.
"The one who handed me the poker." Scarlet's gut twisted. She needed Wolf. She needed answers. But in that moment, she wouldn't have minded seeing him ripped to shreds on that stage. As if sensing her onslaught of rage, Wolf's gaze flickered toward her. The smug amusement dropped away. Scarlet hoped it showed on her face just who she was rooting for. A holograph flickered to life, hanging over the announcer's head. The words slowly rotated and flickered. Hunter, 34, versus Wolf, 11.
Tonight, our reigning undefeated champion, Hunter! Cried the announcer. The crowd bellowed. Takes on undefeated newcomer, Wolf!
Mixed boos and cheers. Evidently, not everyone had bet against him. Scarlet was hardly listening, straining hard at the holograph. Wolf, 11. 11 wins, she suspected. 11 fights. 11 nights? Her grandmother had been missing for 17 days and counting, but her father, hadn't he said they'd only kept him for a week? She frowned, frustrated from the calculations. Hunter yelled,
"We're having Wolf for dinner tonight!"
Hundreds of hands slapped against the edge of the platform, like a roll of thunder. Wolf's concentration darkened into something thirsty but patient. The holograph flashed bright red, then evaporated with the sound of a bellowing horn. The mediator dropped down to the crowd, and the fight began. Hunter threw the first punch. Scarlet gasped, the movement almost too quick to follow, but Wolf ducked easily and skirted out from Hunter's shadow. Hunter was impressively fast for his bulk, but Wolf was faster. A series of blows were deflected until Hunter's fist finally connected with a sickening crunch. Scarlet recoiled. The crowd erupted, pushing and screaming against her. The frenzy was palpable, the crowd salivating for blood. Moving as if it were all choreographed, Wolf aimed a solid kick to Hunter's chest. A loud thud shook the ground as Hunter was knocked onto his back. He was only down for a moment before jumping to his feet. Wolf inched away, waiting. Blood was dribbling from his lips, but he didn't seem bothered by it. His eyes glowed. Hunter attacked with renewed vigor. Wolf took a punch in the stomach and crumpled over with a grunt. It was followed by a blow that sent him careening to the edge of the stage. He stumbled to one knee, but was up on his feet before Hunter could come closer. He shook his head in an oddly dog-like manner, wild hair flying, and then crouched with his big hands poised at his sides, staring at Hunter with that peculiar grin. Scarlet wrapped her fingers around her sweatshirt's zipper, wondering if that tick was how Wolf had gotten his nickname. When Hunter came barreling across the stage again, Wolf lunged to his side and aimed a kick square in Hunter's back. Hunter collapsed to both knees. The crowd booed. A roundhouse kick, this one at Hunter's ear, sent him sprawling on his side. Hunter made to get up, but Wolf aimed for his ribs, sending him back onto the stage. The crowd was in a fervor, screeching and calling foul. Wolf stepped back, allowing Hunter time to pull himself up by the ropes and settle back into his fighting stance. There was a new glint in Wolf's eye, like he was enjoying this. And when his tongue darted out to lick the blood from his mouth, Scarlet grimaced. A raging bull, Hunter charged again. Wolf blocked one punch with his forearm but took another in his side. Then his elbow shot out, catching Hunter in the jaw, and Scarlet knew he'd taken the hit intentionally. Hunter stumbled backward. A heel in the chest nearly knocked him off his feet again. Wolf landed a punch to his nose, and a spurt of blood oozed down Hunter's chin. A knee in Hunter's side had him crouching over, groaning. Scarlet flinched with each blow, her stomach roiling. How could people stand to watch this? To enjoy this? Hunter fell to his knees, and Wolf was behind him in a breath, his face violently contorted, his hands on each side of Hunter's head. handed me the poker. And this man, this monster, had her grandmother. Scarlett clamped both hands over her mouth, smothering the cry as her ears waited for the snap of Hunter's neck. Wolf froze and blinked at her. His eyes flickered, empty and mad one moment, then almost dazed, surprised to see her there. His pupils widened. Revulsion burned through Scarlett's nerves. She wanted to look away, wanted to run, but she was anchored to the ground. Then Wolf leaped back, letting Hunter slump to the stage under his own weight. The horn blared again. The crowd was a mixture of cheers and boos, delight and anger, outright glee at seeing the great Hunter defeated. None of them minded the blind cruelty or the fact they'd almost witnessed a murder. As the mediator climbed up onto the ropes to announce Wolf as the winner, Wolf peeled his focus away from Scarlett, shoved past the man, and hauled himself over the ropes. The crowd surged away from him, shoving Scarlett backward. She barely kept her balance as she was nearly crushed from the shuffling crowd. Wolf sprang up, using his hands and feet to propel him forward. Sprinting full speed, he disappeared through the yawning exit and dashed off into the silvery weeds. Red and blue flashed in the distance. The crowd swarmed, buzzing with confusion and curiosity. The muttered consensus seemed to be that Wolf was a new hero, but a savage one. It wasn't long before someone else noticed the lights and panic swept through them. People at first spouting defiant words against the police before rushing for the door and scattering across the abandoned farm. Scarlett was shaking as she pulled her hood up and fled with them. Not everyone was running. Someone behind her was trying to call order. There was a gunshot and mad laughter. Up ahead, the girl with the zebra hair was standing on a storage crate, pointing and laughing at the cowards who would flee from the police. Scarlett escaped into the midnight air and the noise faded without the warehouse's echo around her. She could hear the sirens now, mixing with the thrum of crickets. On the dirt road outside the building, she spun in a full circle as the crowd jostled around her. There was no sign of Wolf. She thought she'd seen him turn right. Her ship was parked to the left. Her pulse was racing, making it hard to breathe. She couldn't leave. She hadn't gotten what she'd come for. She told herself that she would be able to find him again, when she'd had time to gather her wits. After she talked to the detectives and persuaded them to track Wolf down and arrest him and find out where he'd taken her grandmother. Tucking her hands into her pockets, she hurried around the building toward her ship. A sickening howl stopped her, sucking the air out of her lungs. The night's chatter silenced, even the loitering city rats pausing to listen. Scarlett had heard wild wolves before, prowling the countryside in search of easy prey on the farms. But never had a wolf's howl sent a chill down her spine like that. Chapter 9.
Urgh! Get it off! Get it off!
Cinder spun, steadying herself on the curve, slick concrete walls as she cast the flashlight behind her. Thorn was writhing and squirming in the cramped tunnel, swatting at his back and emitting an array of curses and unmanly shrieks. She sent the beam of light to the ceiling and saw a thriving mass of cockroaches scuttling across it in all directions. She shuddered, but turned away and kept moving. "It's only a cockroach," she called back to him. "It's not going to kill you."
"It's in my uniform! Would you keep quiet? There's a manhole up ahead. Please tell me we'll be exiting through that manhole."
She scoffed, more preoccupied with the map of the sewer system in her head than on her companion's squeamishness. Even though the thought of a cockroach beneath her shirt did make her squirm, she figured it would still be preferable to walking through the ankle-deep sludge with one bare foot, and she wasn't whining. They passed beneath the manhole, and Cinder detected the steady sound of water growing louder.
"We're almost to the combined main line," she said,
at first eager to reach it. It was hot as Mars in this cramped tunnel, and her thighs were burning from the crouch walk routine. But then, a gut-turning stench wafted toward her, so strong, she almost gagged. No longer would it just be surface water runoff they were trekking through.
"Oh, aces," said Thorn, groaning. "Tell me that's not what I think it is."
Cinder wrinkled her nose and focused on taking shallow, burning breaths. The smell grew nearly unbearable as they traipsed through the sludge and came to the sewer connection, finding themselves on the lip of a concrete wall. Cinder's embedded flashlight searched the tunnel beneath them, darting up the slimy concrete walls. The main tunnel would be tall enough for them to stand in. The light bounced off a narrow metal grate that lined the far edge, stable enough for maintenance workers and covered in rat droppings. Between them and the grate, a river of sewage swelled and churned, at least 2 meters wide. She fought off another bout of nausea as the pungent stink of the sewer clouded her nostrils, her throat, her lungs.
"Ready?" she said, inching forward.
"Wait, what are you doing?
What does it look like?"
Thorn blinked at her, then down at the sewage he could barely make out in the darkness.
"Don't you have some tool in that fancy hand of yours that can get us across?"
Cinder glared, lightheaded from her body's instinctively short breaths.
"Oh, wow. How could I have forgotten about my grappling hook?"
Spinning away, she gobbled down another rank breath and lowered herself into the muck. Something smooshed between her toes. The current pounded against her legs as she made her way across, the water up to her thighs. Writhing on the inside, Cinder crossed as quickly as she could, choking down her gag reflex, the weight of her metal foot keeping her grounded so the current didn't knock her off balance, and soon she was on the other side, pulling herself onto the grate. She flattened her back against the tunnel wall and peered back at the pretend captain. He was staring at her legs with unbridled disgust. Cinder looked down. The stark white jumper was now tinged greenish-brown and clung, sopping to her legs.
"Look!"
she yelled, aiming the flashlight at Thorn.
"You can either get over here, or you can go back and serve the rest of your sentence in peace. But you have to make a decision now!"
After a stream of curses and spitting, Thorn inched his way into the sludge, holding his arms aloft. He was grimacing the whole time as he slinked his way to the grate and hauled himself up beside Cinder.
"This is what I get for complaining about the soap," he muttered, pressing himself against the wall.
The grate was already digging into Cinder's bare foot, and she shifted her weight onto her cyborg leg.
"All right, cadet, which way?"
"Captain."
He opened his eyes and peered down the tunnel in each direction. But beyond the pale light filtering in from the closest manhole, the sewers disappeared in blackness. Cinder adjusted the brightness of her flashlight, sending it darting over the frothy surface of the water and dripping concrete walls.
"It's near the old Bay High Park,"
Thorn said, scratching at his whiskered chin.
"Which way is that?"
Cinder nodded and turned south. Her internal clock told her they'd been walking for only 12 minutes, but it seemed like hours. The grate dug into her foot with every step. Her wet pants were plastered to her calves, and sweat dripped down the back of her neck, sometimes tricking her into thinking it was a spider fallen down her jumpsuit and making her feel guilty for giving Thorn a hard time before. Though they didn't see any rats, she could hear them scurrying away from her light, down countless tunnels that fanned out beneath the city. Thorn talked to himself as they walked, working through his clogged memory. His ship was definitely near Bay High Park, in the industrial district, not 6 blocks south of the magleg tracks. Well, maybe 8 blocks.
"We're about a block away from the park," Cinder said, pausing at a metal ladder.
A spot of light drifted down toward them.
This goes up to Wes Yunjin.
Yunjin sounds familiar. Sort of.
She pleaded for patience and started to climb. The ladder rungs bit into her foot, but the air was blissfully fresh as she neared the top. The sound of the rushing water was replaced with the hum of maglev tracks. Reaching the manhole cover, Cinder paused to listen for signs of humanity before pushing the cover off to the side. A hover glided overhead. Cinder ducked, heart racing. Daring to inch her head up, she spotted silent lights atop the white vehicle. It was an emergency hover. Visions of androids armed with brain interface overriding tasers sent a shudder through her. Before the hover turned a corner, she saw a red cross on one side. It was a medical hover, not law enforcement. Cinder nearly collapsed from relief. They were in the old warehouse district, near the plague quarantines. Medical hovers were to be expected. She glanced both ways down the deserted street. Though it was still early, the day was already hot and whimsical mirages were rising from the pavement, having forgotten the drenching summer storm from two nights before.
Clear!
She hauled herself up onto the road and sucked in a deep breath of the city's humidity. Thorn followed, his uniform glaringly bright in the sun, except for the legs, which were still murky green and smelled of sewage.
Which way?
Shielding his eyes with his forearm, Thorn squinted at the concrete buildings and rotated in a full circle. Faced north, scratched his neck. Cinder's optimism crumbled.
Tell me you recognize something.
Yeah, I do, he said, waving her away. I just haven't been here in a while.
Think faster. We aren't exactly blending in with our surroundings out here.
With a nod, Thorn started down the street.
This way.
5 steps later, he paused, pondered, turned around.
No, this way.
We're dead.
No, I've got it now. It's this way.
Don't you have an address?
A captain always knows where his ship is. It's like a psychic bond.
If only we had a captain here.
He ignored her, marching down the street with spectacular confidence. Cinder followed 3 steps behind him, jumping at each sound. Trash skidding across the road, a hover crossing an intersection 2 streets away. The sun glistened off the dusty warehouse windows. 3 empty blocks later, Thorn slowed his pace and peered up at the facade of each building they passed, rubbing his chin. Cinder began desperately searching her brain for Plan B.
There!
Thorn jotted across the street to a warehouse that was identical to every other warehouse, with giant rolling doors and years of colorful graffiti. Rounding the building's corner, he tested the main door.
Locked.
Spotting the ID scanner beside the door, Cinder cursed.
Figures.
Kneeling down, she pried the plastic face off the scanner.
I might be able to disable it. Do you think there's an alarm?
There better be. I haven't been paying rent all this time for my darling to sit in an unprotected warehouse.
Cinder had just downloaded the programming manual for the scanner's product number when the door beside them swung open and a plump man with a thin black goatee stepped out into the sunlight. Cinder froze.
Carswell! The man barked. Just saw the news. I thought you might be showing up here.
Alec, how are you? A grin broke across Thorn's face. Am I really on the news? How do I look?
Without answering, Alec swerved his attention towards Cinder. His friendliness froze over, buried beneath a trace of discomfort. Gulping, Cinder shut the scanner's panel and stood. Her netlink was already connecting to the news feed she abandoned during their escape. And, sure enough, there was a stream of warnings flashing across her own picture. The one they'd taken when she'd been admitted into the prison. Escaped convict, considered armed and dangerous. If seen, calm this link immediately.
Seen you on the news, too, Alec said, glancing at her steel foot. Alec, I'm here to pick up my ship. We're in a bit of a hurry.
As sympathetic wrinkles creased the corner of Alec's mouth, he shook his head.
I can't help you, Carswell. The feds watch me close enough as it is. Storing a stolen ship is one thing. I can always claim ignorance to that. But assisting a convicted felon and assisting one of them?
His nose wrinkled at Cinder, but he simultaneously took a step back, as if afraid of her retaliation.
If they track you here and find out I helped, it's more trouble than even I can risk. You'd better just hang low for a time. I won't tell I saw you, but I won't let you take your ship. Not now. Not until all this blows over. You understand, right?
Thorn flushed with disbelief.
But she's my ship. I'm a paying customer. You can't just keep her from me. Each man for himself. You know how it is well as anyone.
Alex slid his gaze back toward Cinder, his fear easing more and more into revulsion.
Get on your way now, and I won't calm the police. If they come around, I'll tell them I haven't seen you since you dropped off the ship last year. But if you stay here much longer, I'll calm them myself. I swear I will.
No sooner had he finished speaking than Cinder heard a hover down the street. Her heart skipped at the sight of a white emergency hover. This one, without the red cross on its side. But it disappeared down another street. She spun back toward Alec.
We don't have anywhere else to go. We need that ship.
He stepped back from her again, his body framed in the doorway.
Look here, little girl, he said,
his tone determined despite the way his attention kept swooping down to her metal hand.
I'm trying to help you out because Carswell's been a good customer of mine. And I don't rat out my customers. But it's no favor to you. I wouldn't blink twice before sending you off to rot. It's the best your kind deserve. Now get away from my warehouse before I change my mind.
Desperation welled inside Cinder. She clenched her fists as a surge of electricity lashed out, blinding her. White-hot pain flared up from the base of her neck, flooding her skull, but it was blessedly brief and left bright spots sparking in her vision. Panting, she reeled back the burning energy, just in time to see Alec's eyes roll back. He toppled forward, landing in Thorn's arms. Cinder staggered against the wall, dizzy.
Oh, stars! Is he dead?
Thorn groaned from the weight.
No, but I think he's having a heart attack.
It's not a heart attack, she murmured. He'll be fine.
She said it as much to convince herself as him, having to believe these accidental flares of her lunar gift weren't dangerous, that she wasn't becoming the terror to society that everyone believed her to be.
Aces, he weighs a ton.
Cinder grabbed Alec's feet and together they dragged him into the building. An office to their left had two net screens, one with a security feed showing the warehouse's exterior, just as the door closed behind two white-clad fugitives and the unconscious man. The other screen showed a muted news anchor.
He may be a selfish jerk, but he sure does have good taste in jewelry.
Thorn held up Alec's hand by the thumb, fiddling with a silver-plated band around his wrist, a miniature port watch.
Would you focus?
Cinder hauled Thorn to his feet. Turning, she scanned the massive warehouse. It stretched out the full length of the city block, filled with dozens of spaceships, large and small, new and old. Cargo ships, pod ships, personal flyers, race ships, ferries, cruisers.
Which one is it?
Hey, look, there was another jailbreak.
Cinder glanced at the net screen, which now showed the chairman of national security talking to a crowd of journalists. On the bottom of the screen scrolled the words, Lunar escapes from New Beijing prison. Considered extremely dangerous.
This is great,
said Thorn, nearly knocking her over with a slap on her back.
They're not going to worry about us if they have a lunar to track down.
Cinder dragged her attention away from the broadcast, just as his grin fell.
Wait, your lunar?
You're a criminal mastermind?
Spinning on her heels, she stalked into the warehouse.
Where's this ship? Hold on there, little traitor.
Breaking out of jail is one thing, but assisting a psychotic lunar is a bit out of my league.
Cinder rounded on him. First, I'm not psychotic. And second, if it wasn't for me, you would still be sitting in that jail cell ogling your port screen. So you owe me. Besides, they've already got you pegged as my accomplice. You look like an idiot in that picture, by the way.
Thorne followed her gesture to the screen. His own jail picture was blown up beside hers.
I think I look pretty good.
Thorne! Captain! Please!
He blinked at her, a touch of smugness wiped quickly away by a brisk nod.
Right. Let's get out of here.
Cinder sighed in relief, following Thorne as he marched into the maze of ships.
I hope it's not one in the middle.
Doesn't matter, he said, pointing up. The roof opens.
Cinder glanced up at the seam in the middle of the ceiling.
That's convenient.
And there she is. Cinder followed Thorne's gesture. His ship was larger than she'd expected. Much larger. A 214 Rampian Class 11.3 cargo ship. Cinder pulled up her retina scanner and downloaded the ship's blueprint, speechless at everything it could claim. The engine room and a fully stocked dock with two satellite pod ships took up the underbelly, while the main level housed the cargo bay, cockpit, galley kitchen, six crew quarters, and a shared washroom. She rounded to the main entry hatch and saw that the seal of the American Republic had been hastily painted over with the silhouette of a lounging naked lady.
Nice touch.
Thanks. Did it myself.
Despite her worries that the painting could make them more easily identified, she couldn't help being faintly impressed.
It's bigger than I expected.
There was a time when she housed a 12-man crew, Thorne said, petting her hull.
Should be plenty of room for avoiding each other, then.
Cinder paced beneath the hatch, waiting for Thorne to open it. But when she glanced back, she found him lovingly rubbing his temple against the ship's underside and cooing about how much he'd missed her. Cinder was in the middle of rolling her eyes when an unfamiliar voice ricocheted through the warehouse.
Over here!
Turning, she saw someone crouched over Alec's body, haloed in a square of light. They wore the unmistakable uniform of the Eastern Commonwealth military. Cinder swore.
Time to go! Now!
Thorne ducked toward the hatch.
Rampian, code word. Captain is king. Open hatch.
They waited, but nothing happened. Cinder raised panicked eyebrows.
Captain is king! Captain is king! Rampian, wake up! It's Thorne! Captain Carswell Thorne! What the...
Cinder shushed him. Beyond the ship's hull, four men were making their way through the crowded warehouse, flashlights shining off the assorted landing gear.
Maybe the power cell is dead, said Cinder. How? It's just been sitting here.
Did you leave the headlights on? She snapped.
Thorne harrumphed and crouched against the ship. Footsteps grew louder.
Or it could be the auto control system, Cinder mused, racking her brain.
She'd never worked on anything larger than a pod ship before, but how different could they be?
Do you have the override key?
He blinked at her.
Yeah, let me just pull it out of my prison-issued pocket and we'll be on our way.
Cinder glared, but was silent as an officer passed two aisles away.
Stay here, she whispered. Keep trying to get in and take off as fast as possible.
Where are you going?
Without answering, she slinked around the side of the ship, a blueprint already streaming to her retina display. She found the access hatch and pried it open as quietly as she could, before crawling up into the ship undercarriage, contorting her body to avoid the wires and cables that crammed the space. She pulled the hatch shut behind her with a dull click, and found herself encased in darkness. The second interior door was more difficult to break into, but between the flashlight and her screwdriver, she was soon wriggling out of the insulating layer and into the engine room. Her flashlight beam zipped across the massive engine. She found the computer motherboard on the blue lines overlaying her vision and squirmed toward it. Pulling the universal connector cable from her hand, She snapped it into the main computer terminal. Her flashlight dimmed as her own power was diverted. Pale green text scrawled across her eyesight. Diagnosing computer system, model 135 V8.2. 5%, 12%, 16%. Chapter 10. Thorn jumped at a clang overhead. A man's voice followed.
"Hear that?"
Thorn crouched down between the ship's landing feet and flattened himself against a metal beam.
"Captain is king," he whispered. "Captain is king. Captain is ki-"
A subtle hum pulsed over his head. Pale running lights flickered on near the ship's nose.
"Captain is..."
Gears started to rattle before he could finish. The hatch opened, the ramp lowering onto the concrete. Heart leaping, Thorn dodged out beneath it, just in time to avoid being squashed.
"Over there!"
A flashlight beam fell over Thorn as he swung himself up onto the descending ramp.
"Rampian, close hatch!"
The ship didn't respond. A gun fired. The bullet pinged off the ship's overhead light. Thorn ducked behind one of the plastic crates that filled the cargo bay.
"Rampian, close hatch!"
"I'm working on it!"
He froze, glancing up at the pipes and tubes that lined the ship's ceiling.
"Rampian?"
The following silence was punctuated by the clang of the ramp on the outside concrete, the thumping of booted feet. Then the ramp creaked again and started to rise back up. A shower of bullets lodged into the plastic storage crates, pinging off the metal walls. Thorn covered his head and waited until the ramp was closed enough to block the bullet's path before shoving himself away from the crate and running toward the cockpit. The ship vibrated as the ramp slammed shut. A volley of bullets pinged against the hull. Thorn scrambled toward the emergency lights that framed the cockpit, shoving aside unopened crates. His knee smacked something hard, and he let out a string of curses as he collapsed into the pilot seat. The windows were dirty, and all he could see in the dark warehouse were the faint lights of Alec's office and the flashlight beams darting around the Rampian, searching for another way in.
"Rampian, ready for liftoff!"
The dash lit up with controls and screens, only the most important ones. The same sterile feminine voice came over the ship's speakers.
"Thorn, I can't set the automatic lift. You're going to have to take off manually."
He gaped at the controls.
"Why is my ship talking back to me?"
"It's me, you idiot."
He cocked his ear toward the speaker.
"Cinder?"
"Listen, the auto control system has a bug. The power cell is on the fritz, too. I think I can make it, but you're going to have to take off without computer assistance."
The words, too dry in the computer's tone, were punctuated by another round of bullets against the ship's closed hatch. Thorn gulped.
"Without computer assistance? Are you sure?"
A short silence was followed by the voice again, and Thorn thought he could detect Cinder's screeching, despite its monotone.
"You do know how to fly, right?"
Thorn scanned the controls before him. "Yes?"
He squared his shoulders and reached for the controller that was attached to the ceiling. A moment later, a slash of sunlight cut across the warehouse as the roof opened down the middle. Something pounded against the ship's side.
Yeah, I hear you,"
Thorn jabbed the ignition. The lights across the dash dimmed as the engine thrummed to life.
"Here we go."
Another crash echoed from outside the hatch. He jogged a few switches, engaging hover mode, and eased the ship off the ground. She rose up smoothly, the magnets beneath the city pushing the ship easily as a dandelion seed, and Thorn exhaled a long breath. Then the ship warbled and began to tilt.
Whoa, don't do that!
Thorn's pulse raced as he leveled the ship.
"The power cell is going to die. You have to engage the backup thrusters."
"Engage the backup what?" "Oh, never mind, I found them."
The engine flared again. With a sudden jolt of power, the ship lurched to the opposite side, and Thorn heard a crunch as she rammed into the next ship. The Rampian shuddered and started to slip back toward the ground. Another rainfall of bullets beat against the starboard side. A drop of sweat slid down Thorne's back.
"What are you doing up there?"
"Stop distracting me!" he yelled, gripping the controls and righting the ship.
Overcompensated, the ship tilted too far to the right.
"We're going to die!"
"This isn't as easy as it looks," Thorne leveled her out again. "I usually have an automated stabilizer to take care of this."
To his surprise, no sarcastic comment was spat back at him. A moment later, another panel lit up. "Magnetic conductors stabilizing. Power output 37 over 63, 38 over 62, 42 over 58. The ship settled calmly beneath him, once again trembling in midair.
"Right, like that."
Thorne's knuckles whitened on the controls as he arched the ship's nose up toward the open roof. The engine's purr became a roar as the ship soared upward. He heard the last ricochet of bullets, and then they fell away as the ship broke free of the warehouse and was flooded with the light from the yellow sun.
"Come on, darling," he murmured,
squeezing his eyes shut as, without resistance, without wavering, the ship left the protective magnetic field of the city behind, drew on the full power of her thrusters, and speared through the wispy clouds that lingered in the morning sky. The towering skyscrapers of downtown New Beijing dropped away, and then it was only him in the sky and the endless landscape of space. Thorne's fingers stayed clamped like iron shackles around the controls until the ship had erupted from Earth's atmosphere. Lightheaded, he adjusted the thruster output as the ship slipped into natural orbit before prying his hands away from the controls. He slumped, shaking, back in the chair. It took him a long time to speak, waiting for his heartbeat to slow to a manageable pace.
"Good work, cyborg girl," he said.
"If you were hoping for a permanent position on my crew, you're hired."
The speakers were silent.
"I don't mean a lowly position, either. First mate is available. Well, I mean, pretty much every position is available. Mechanic, cook. A pilot would be nice, so I don't have to go through that again."
He waited.
"Cinder, are you there?"
When still there was no response, he pushed himself out of his chair and stumbled out of the cockpit, past the cargo bay, and into the corridor that split off to the crew's quarters. His legs were weak as he reached for the hatch that led into the ship's lower level. He clomped down the ladder into the tiny hall between the engine room and the pod ship dock. The screen beside the engine room didn't offer any warnings of space vacuums or unsafe compressions. It also didn't say anything about a living girl inside. Thorne tapped the unlock icon on the screen and twisted the door's manual bolt, then shoved the door open. The engine was loud and hot and smelled like melted rubber.
"Hello?"
he called into the dark.
"Cyborg girl? Are you in here?"
If she responded, the words were lost in the engine's thrumming. Thorne gulped.
"Lights on?"
A red emergency light brightened above the doorway, casting gloomy shadows over the enormous revolving engine and the masses of cords and coils that sprawled out beneath it. Thorne squinted, spotting something almost white. Sinking to his hands and knees, he crawled toward her.
"Cyborg girl?"
She didn't move. As Thorne came closer, he saw that she was on her back, dark hair sprawled across her face. Her robotic hand was plugged into the port of an exposed computer panel.
"Hey, you,"
he said, hovering over her. He peeled up her eyelids, but her gaze was dark and empty. Craning down, Thorne placed an ear against her chest, but if there was a heartbeat, it was drowned out by the roaring engine.
"Come on,"
he growled, reaching for her hand and working the connector out of the port. The nearest computer panel went dark.
"Auto control system disconnected,"
lilted a robotic voice overhead, startling Thorne.
"Engaging default system procedures."
"Good plan," he muttered, grabbing her ankles.
Thorn dragged her slowly into the hallway and propped her up against the corridor wall. Whatever her cyborg parts were made of, it was a lot heavier than flesh and bone. He pressed an ear to her chest again. This time, he was met with a faint beat.
"Wake up,"
he said, shaking her. Cinder's head slumped forward. Sitting back on his heels, Thorn screwed up his lips. The girl was horribly pale and filthy from their trek through the sewers, but in the hallway's brightness, he could tell she was breathing, if barely.
"What, do you have a power button or something?"
His attention fell on her metal hand with the cord and plug still dangling from her knuckle. Grabbing her hand, he peered at it from every angle. He remembered a flashlight, a screwdriver, and a knife in three of the fingers. But he wasn't yet sure what her pointer finger was hiding. If it was a power button, he couldn't see any way of getting at it. The connector cable, though.
Right!
Thorn jumped up, nearly toppling into the wall. He jabbed at the screen that opened the door to the podship dock. White lights flared overhead as he entered. He grasped Cinder's wrists and tugged her into the dock, dropping her in between two small satellite ships that sat like toadstools among a mess of cables and service tools. Panting, he reeled the podship's charging cord out of the wall, then froze, staring at the girl's cable, at the ship's cable, at the girl. He cursed again and dropped them both. Two males. Even he could tell that they wouldn't connect. Knocking his knuckles against his temple, Thorn forced himself to think. Another idea flashed, and he squinted down at the girl. She seemed to be growing paler still, but maybe that was a trick of the lighting.
"Oh,"
he said, a new idea dropping into his brain.
"Oh, boy, you don't think... Oh, that's disgusting."
Shoving away his squeamishness, he gently pulled the girl toward him so that she collapsed over one arm. With his free hand, he searched around her tangled hair until he discovered the tiny latch just above her neck. He looked away as he opened it, before daring to peer inside from the corner of his eye. A jumble of wires and computer chips and switches that made absolutely no sense to Thorn filled a shallow compartment in the back of her skull. He let out a breath, glad that the control panel completely hid any brain tissue from sight. At its base, he spotted what appeared to be a small outlet, the same size as the plugs.
"Ouch,"
Thorn muttered, reaching for the podship cable again and hoping that he wasn't about to make a huge mistake. He wiggled the plug of the recharging cord into her control panel. It snapped into place. He swallowed a breath. Nothing happened. Sitting back, Thorn held Cinder at arm's length. He pushed her hair back from her face and waited. 12 heartbeats later, something hummed inside her skull. It grew louder, and then fell silent altogether. Thorn gulped. The girl's left shoulder jerked out of Thorn's grip. He dropped her onto the floor, letting her head lull to one side. Her leg flailed, nearly catching Thorn in the groin, and he shoved himself away from her, planting his back against the podship's landing treads. The girl sucked in a quick breath, held it for a couple of seconds, then released it with a groan.
"Cinder, are you alive?"
A series of milder spasms worked their way out of her robotic limbs. Then she scrunched up her whole face as if biting into a lemon. Eyelids twitching, she managed to squint up at him.
"Cinder?"
She eased herself up to sitting. Her jaw and tongue worked silently for a moment, and when she spoke, the words were heavily slurred.
"Auto-controlled faults. Almost drained my power system."
"I think it did drain your power system."
She frowned and seemed momentarily uncertain before reaching for the cord still plugged into her brain. Yanking it out, she slammed the panel shut.
"You opened my control panel?"
she said, her words a little clearer with anger behind them. He scowled.
"I didn't want to."
Her expression was sour as she peered at him. Not entirely angry, but not grateful either. They stared at each other for a long time. as the engine hummed across the hallway and a light in the corner started to go out, flickering at random intervals.
"Well," Cinder finally grumbled, "I guess that was pretty fast thinking."
A relieved grin filled up Thorne's face.
"We're having another moment, aren't we?"
"If by a moment you mean me not wanting to strangle you for the first time since we met, then I guess we are." Cinder slumped back on the floor. "Although, maybe I'm just too exhausted to want to strangle anybody."
"I'll take it," said Thorne, stretching out on the floor beside her and enjoying the cold hardness of the dock's floor,
the obnoxiously glaring lights overhead, the stink of sewage on their clothes, and the perfect sensation of freedom. Book 2. Little Red was a tender young morsel, and the wolf knew she would be even tastier than the old woman. Chapter 11. The egg hissed as it slid into the melted butter, its vivid yolk drizzling into the white. Scarlet brushed a tufted feather off the next egg before cracking it open with one hand, simultaneously pushing the spatula across the bottom of the pan. The oozing whites grew opaque, fluffed up, developed a crackling film near the pan's edges. Otherwise, the house was silent. She'd checked in on her dad when she'd gotten home from the fight and found him comatose in her grandma's bed, a bottle of whiskey stolen from the kitchen left open on the dresser. She'd emptied the rest of the whiskey into the garden, along with every other bottle of liquor she could find, then spent 4 hours tossing in her own bed. Her head was full with the previous evening, the burn marks on her dad's arm, the terror in his face, his desperation to find whatever her grandmère had hidden. And Wolf, with his tattoo and his intense looks and his almost convincing tone. "It wasn't me." Letting the spatula balance on the edge of the pan, Scarlet pulled a plate from the cabinet and sliced a hunk of stale bread from the loaf on the counter. The horizon was glowing and a clear sky promised another sunny day, but a wind had kicked up in the night, tossing the corn stalks and whistling past the chimney. A rooster crowed in the yard. Sighing, she spooned the eggs onto the plate before sitting down at the dining table. She shoveled the food into her mouth, while her hunger was stronger than her nerves. With her free hand, she reached for the port screen on the table and established a net link. "Search," she muttered through a half-full mouth. "Tattoo, L-S-O-P. Unable to identify command. Grumbling, she typed in the terms and swallowed the last of the eggs while a stream of links came up. Extreme tattoos, tattoo designs, virtual tattoo models, the science behind tattoo removal, the latest in tattoo technology, virtually painless. She tried tattoo LSOP 962. No matches found. She picked up the bread and ripped out a hunk with her teeth. Forearm, tattoo, numbers. A collection of images filled the screen. Arms skinny and bulky, pale and dark, covered with garish drawings or displaying small, tiny symbols on their wrists. 13s and Roman numerals, birth dates and geographical coordinates. The first year of peace, 1TE, was popular. Jaw beginning to ache, Scarlet dropped the rest of the bread down on the plate and rubbed her palms into her eyes. Street fighter tattoos? Kidnapper tattoos? Mafia tattoos? Who were these people? She stood up and started a pot of coffee. "Wolf," she whispered to herself as the water began to percolate. She let the word linger, feeling it on her lips. To some, a wild beast, a predator, a nuisance. To others, a shy animal who was too often misunderstood by humanity. An uneasiness still lingered in the pit of her stomach. She couldn't get the memory of him out of her head, nearly killing his opponent amid all those spectators, before running out into the fields like a man possessed. At the time, she'd believed that the howl she'd heard minutes later had been a true wolf prowling the farms. They certainly weren't uncommon, not after the Species Protection Act that had been enforced centuries ago. But her certainty was failing. "They call me Wolf at the fights." She put her plate and the empty fry pan into the sink, running cool water over them while she scanned the field's swaying shadows through the window. Soon, the farm would be filled with life, androids and workers and genetically enhanced honeybees. She poured the coffee before it was finished, topping her mug with a splash of fresh milk, and sat back at the table. Wolves. An image of a gray wolf filled the screen, fangs bared, ears flattened. Snowflakes clung to its thick coat. Scarlet dragged her finger across the screen, sending the picture away. The images that followed were more peaceful. Wolves tumbling with their mates, cubs sleeping piled on top of one another, regal white and gray pelted wolves creeping through autumn woods. She chose a link from one of the Species Preservation Societies and scanned the text, pausing when she came to the section on howling. Wolves howl in order to gain the attention of their pack or send territorial warnings. Lone wolves who have become separated from their pack will howl in order to find their companions. Often, the alpha male is the most aggressive howler of the pack. His aggressiveness can be detected in his low-pitched, rough howls when he approaches a stranger. A chill shook Scarlet so hard, her coffee splashed up over the rim of her mug. Cursing, she stood to grab a towel and mopped it up, annoyed at being spooked by a stupid article. Did she honestly think the crazy street fighter had been trying to communicate with his pack? She threw the towel into the sink and grabbed the port screen, skimming through the rest of the article before following a link about pack hierarchy. Wolves travel in packs, groups that range from 6 to 15 members and have an established hierarchy. At the top of the social structure are the alpha male and alpha female, a mated pair. Though they are frequently the only wolves in the pack who will breed and produce a litter, all other pack members assist in feeding and raising the pups. Males will establish their alpha rank through ritual combat. One wolf may challenge another, resulting in a fight that determines which wolf is superior. Repeated victories will earn respect for the male wolf and ultimately decide the pack leader. The next step in the pack hierarchy are the beta wolves, who often hunt and provide protection to the cubs. The omega wolf is the lowest ranking in the pack, often treated as a scapegoat. The omegas are occasionally picked on by the rest of the pack. This can lead to the omega drifting to the edges of the pack's territory and, on occasion, leaving the pack altogether. A flurry of clucking startled Scarlet. Setting the port on the counter, she peered out the window. Her stomach flipped. The shadow of a man stretched across the yard, the gathered hens skittering away from him toward their coop. As if sensing her, Wolf glanced up and spotted Scarlet in the window. She spun away, swallowing the rising panic. She ran into the foyer and snatched her grandmother's shotgun from its corner beneath the stairs. Wolf hadn't moved by the time she'd thrown open the front door. The chickens were already growing familiar with the stranger, pecking around his feet in search of falling seed. Scarlet settled the gun in her arms and released the safety. If he was surprised, he didn't show it. "What do you want?" she yelled, startling the hens away from him. The light from the house spilled around her onto the gravel. Her shadow shifted across the drive, almost brushing Wolf's feet. The madness from the fight was gone, and the bruises on his face were nearly invisible. He seemed calm and unconcerned with the gun, though he didn't move toward her. After a long silence, he raised both hands to either side of his head, open-palmed. "I'm sorry I frightened you again." As if to make amends, he backed away, 2, 3 steps. "You have a gift," she deadpanned. "Keep your hands up." His fingers twitched in acknowledgement. Scarlet paced out from the door, but she stopped when the gravel bit into her bare feet. her senses prickled, waiting for Wolf to make any sudden movement. But he was as still as the stone house behind her.
"I've already calmed the police," she lied, her thoughts stretching back to the port screen left on the kitchen counter. His eyes caught the light, and Scarlett suddenly remembered her dad sleeping upstairs. Was it too much to hope that her raised voice could dislodge him from his stupor?
"How did you get here?"
"Walked, well, ran mostly," he said, hands still raised. The wind was making messy patterns in his hair. "Would you like me to leave?"
The question took her off guard.
"I want you to tell me what you're doing here. If you think I'm afraid of you..."
"I'm not trying to scare you."
With a glare, she peered down the barrel to make sure she still had him in line.
"I wanted to talk about what you said at the fight, about the tattoo, and what happened to your grandmother and your father."
Scarlett clenched her jaw.
"How did you find out where I live?"
His brow furrowed, as if in confusion.
"Your ship has the name of your farm on it, so I looked it up. I don't mean you any harm. It just seemed like you needed help."
"Help?" Heat flared in her cheeks. "From the psychopath who tortured my dad? Who kidnapped my grandmother?"
"It wasn't me," he said, his tone unwavering. "There are other tattoos like mine. It was someone else."
"Oh, really? Like you're part of some cult or something?"
The feathered body of one of the chickens pressed against her leg, and she started, barely managing to keep the gun level.
"Or something,"
he said with a flinching shrug, one foot crunched against the gravel.
"Don't come any closer," Scarlett yelled.
The chicken clucked and dawdled away.
"I will shoot, you know."
"I know."
A flicker of kindness passed over him, and he pointed at his temple.
"You'll want to aim for the head. That usually makes for a fatal shot. Or if you're feeling shaky, the torso. It's a larger target."
"Your head looks pretty big from here."
He laughed, the expression changing everything about him. His stance relaxed, his face warmed. A disgusted growl vibrated in Scarlett's throat.
This man had no right to be laughing, not when her grandmother was still out there.
Wolf dropped his arms and folded them over his chest. Before Scarlett could order them up again, he was speaking.
"I'd been hoping to impress you last night, but it seemed to backfire on me."
"I'm not usually impressed by men with anger management issues who kidnap my grandmother and follow me around and..."
"I didn't kidnap your grandmother."
For the first time, his words were sharp, stealing the tirade out of Scarlett's mouth. His attention fell down to the gaggle of chickens as they tramped around the door.
"But if it really was someone with a tattoo like mine, I may be able to help figure out who did."
"Why should I believe you?"
He took the question seriously, contemplating for a long while.
"I have no proof other than what I told you last night. I've been in Rieu for nearly 2 weeks. They know me at the tavern. They know me at the fights. If your father were to see me, he wouldn't recognize me, nor would your grandmother."
He shifted his weight, like he was growing anxious from too long standing still.
"I want to help."
Frowning, Scarlett squinted down the double barrels. If he was lying, then this was one of the men who had taken her grandmother from her. He was cruel. He was evil. He deserved a bullet between his eyes. But he was her only lead.
"You'll tell me everything. Everything!"
Pulling her finger off the trigger, she lowered the shotgun so that it pointed instead at his thigh, a non-fatal target.
"And you'll keep your hands where I can see them at all times. Just because I'm letting you into this house doesn't mean I trust you."
"Of course," he nodded, all compliance. "I wouldn't trust me either."
Chapter 12. Scarlett gestured with the gun for Wolf to come inside, glowering as he crept toward the landing. He seemed to brace himself, taking in the stucco walls and dark-stained staircase, before passing by her into the hallway. He had to duck so his head wouldn't hit the doorframe. Scarlett kicked the door shut, refusing to take her eyes from Wolf, who stood still and hunched, his body compacting itself as well as it could. His attention shifted to the rotating digital photos on the wall that showed Scarlet as a child, munching on raw peas from the garden, golden autumnal fields, her grandmother 40 years younger in her first military uniform.
This way.
He followed her gesture into the kitchen. Scarlet glanced at the picture just as her grandmother vanished, before marching in after him. She spotted her port screen on the counter, still displaying a picture of an alpha male with his mate, and slipped it into her pocket. Without turning her back on the street fighter, she propped the gun into a corner of cabinets and grabbed her red hoodie from the back of one of the chairs. She felt less vulnerable as she shoved her arms into the sleeves, even more so when she snatched a carving knife from its block on the counter. Wolf's eyes flickered once to the knife before taking in the rest of the kitchen. They landed on the wire basket beside the sink, his pupils widening with hunger. 6 glossy red tomatoes filled the basket. Scarlet frowned as Wolf dropped his gaze.
"You must be hungry," she muttered. "After all that running." "I'm fine. Have a seat," she said, gesturing at the table with a knife.
Wolf hesitated only for a moment before pulling out a chair. He didn't scoot it back in as he sat, as if he wanted to give himself enough space to jump up and run if he had to.
"Hands where I can see them."
He looked a breath away from amusement as he leaned forward and splayed his fingers on the edge of the table.
"I can't imagine what you must think of me after last night." She scoffed. "Really? You can't imagine?"
She grabbed the cutting board and slammed it down on the table opposite from Wolf.
"Would you like me to clue you in?"
He lowered his gaze, rubbing a finger into an ancient scratch in the wood.
"It's been a long time since I lost control like that. I don't know what happened." "I hope you didn't come here for sympathy."
Refusing to set down the knife or turn her back on him, she had to make 2 more trips from counter to table, grabbing first a loaf of bread, then 2 tomatoes.
"No, I told you why I'm here. It's just that I spent all night trying to figure out what went wrong."
"Perhaps you should go back to the moment you decided that street fighting was a valid career choice." A long silence went unbroken as Scarlet, still standing, sliced a hunk off the bread and tossed it at Wolf, who caught it easily.
"You're right," he said, picking at the crust. "That's probably where it started."
He sank his teeth into the bread, barely chewing before he swallowed. Baffled that he had no argument, no excuse, Scarlet grabbed one of the tomatoes and set it on the cutting board, feeling the need to keep her hands busy. She ruthlessly pushed the knife into its flesh, ignoring the seeds that oozed out onto the board. Skewering the tomato slices, she held them out to him, not bothering with a plate. A mess of breadcrumbs on the table were quickly joined with watery red juice. His gaze was distant as he took the slices from her.
"Thank you."
Scarlet threw the tomato's vine into the sink and wiped her hands on her jeans. Outside, the sun was rising fast, and the chickens were growing restless with their clucking, wondering why Scarlet hadn't fed them breakfast when she'd been out.
"It's so peaceful here," Wolf said.
"I'm not going to hire you." Grabbing the mug of cold and forgotten coffee, Scarlet finally sat down opposite Wolf. The knife lingered on the cutting board, just beyond her fingers. She waited until he was licking the last of the tomato juices from his fingers.
"So, what's the story with the tattoo?"
Wolf glanced down at his forearm. The kitchen light was making his eyes sparkle like gems. But this time, they weren't making Scarlet flustered. All she cared about now were the answers those eyes were hiding. He extended his arm across the table so that the tattoo was fully in the light and pulled the skin taut, like he was seeing it for the first time. LSOP 962.
"Loyal soldier to the Order of the Pack," he said. "Member 962.
He released the skin and curled his shoulders, hunkering down in the chair.
"The biggest mistake I have ever made."
Scarlet's skin tingled.
"And what exactly is the Order of the Pack?" "A gang.
more commonly referred to as the Wolves. They like to call themselves vigilantes and rebels and harbingers of change, but they're not much better than criminals, really. If I can ever afford it, I'll have this awful thing removed.
A gust of wind rattled the oak tree outside the front door, and a flurry of leaves swished against the window.
So you're not a part of it anymore?
He shook his head. Scarlet glared across the table, unable to read him, unable to decipher if he was telling the truth.
The Wolves, she murmured, letting the name sink into her brain. And do they do this often? Take innocent people out of their homes for absolutely no reason?
They have a reason.
Scarlet pulled the drawstring of her hood until it was almost strangling her, before tugging the material back out again.
Why? What would they want with my grandmother?
I don't know.
Don't tell me that! Is it ransom money? What?
His fingers flexed in and out on the table.
She was in the military, he said, gesturing toward the hallway. In those pictures, she was in uniform.
She was a pilot for the EF, but that was years ago, before I was born.
Then maybe she knows something. Or they think she does.
About what?
Military secrets? Top secret weaponry?
Scarlet scooted forward until her stomach pressed against the table's edge.
I thought you said they were common criminals. What do they care about that?
Wolf sighed.
Criminals who think of themselves as...
harbingers of change.
Scarlet gnawed on her lip.
Right. So, what, are they trying to take down the government or something? Start a war?
Wolf glanced out the window as the lights of a small passenger ship skirted along the edge of the field, the first workers arriving for their shift.
I don't know.
No, you do know. You're one of them.
Wolf smiled humorlessly.
I was nothing to them, hardly more than an errand boy. I wasn't let in on any executive plans.
Scarlet folded her arms.
Then take an educated guess.
I know they stole a lot of weapons. They want people to be afraid of them.
He shook his head.
Maybe they want to get their hands on military weaponry.
My grandma wouldn't know anything about that. And even if she did before when she was a pilot, she wouldn't know now.
Wolf opened his palms wide to her.
I'm sorry. I don't know what else it could be, unless you can think of something she may have been involved with.
No, I've been racking my brain since she disappeared, but there's nothing. She was just... she's my grandma.
She gestured out toward the fields.
She owns a farm. She speaks her mind, and she doesn't like being told what to think. But she doesn't have any enemies, not that I know of. Sure, people in town think she's a little eccentric, but there's no one who doesn't like her, and she's just an old woman.
She clasped both hands around the coffee mug and sighed.
You must know how to find them, at least.
Find them? No, it would be suicide.
She tensed. It's not for you to decide.
Wolf scratched behind his neck.
How long ago did they take her?
18 days.
Hysteria worked its way up her throat.
They've had her for 18 days.
His attention was plastered to the table, troubled lines drawn into his brow.
It's too dangerous.
The chair slammed against the floor as Scarlet bolted up.
I asked for information, not a lecture. I don't care how dangerous they are. That's just one more reason I need to find them. Do you know what they could be doing to her right now while you're wasting my time? What they did to my father?
A slam echoed through the house, and Scarlet jumped, barely catching herself before she tripped over the fallen chair. She glanced past Wolf, but the hall was empty. Her heart hiccuped.
Dad?
She bolted into the foyer and thrust open the front door.
Dad!
But outside, the drive was already empty. Chapter 13. Scarlet sprinted into the drive, the gravel biting into her feet. The wind kicked at her curls, throwing them across her face.
Where did he go?
She said, tucking her hair into her hood. The sun was fully over the horizon already,
flecking the crops with gold and filling the drive with swaying shadows.
"Perhaps to feed your birds?"
Wolf pointed as a rooster pecked his way back around the side of the house, meandering toward the vegetable patch. Ignoring the biting gravel, Scarlet jogged around the corner. Oak leaves spun on the wind. The hangar and barn and chicken coop all stood silent in the buffeting dawn. There was no trace of her father.
"He must have been looking for something, or..."
Scarlet's heart skipped.
"My ship!"
She ran, ignoring the rocky drive, the prickly weeds. She nearly plowed into the hangar's door, but managed to grasp the handle and yank it open, just as a crash shook the building.
"Dad!"
But he was not inside the ship, preparing to fly off with it, as she'd feared. Instead, he was standing on top of the cabinets that ran the length of the far wall, reaching into the overhead cupboards and tossing their contents onto the floor. Paint cans, extension cords, drill bits. An entire standing toolbox had been tipped over, flooding the concrete with screws and bolts, and two metal cabinets on the back wall stood wide open, showing an assortment of military pilot uniforms, coveralls, and a single straw gardening hat shoved into a corner.
"What are you doing?"
Scarlet strode toward him, then ducked and froze as a wrench sailed by her head. When a crash didn't follow, she glanced back to see Wolf gripping the wrench a foot from his face, blinking in surprise. Scarlet spun back.
"Dad, what?"
"There's something here," he said, yanking open another cupboard.
He snatched up a tin can and tipped it over, mesmerized as hundreds of rusted nails crashed and clanged on the floor.
"Dad, stop! There's nothing here!"
She picked her way through the mess, more aware of rusty sharp bits than she had been of the jagged rocks outside.
"Stop it!"
"There is something here, Scar!"
Tucking a metal barrel under one arm, her dad hopped off the counter and crouched, working the plug out from the hole in the top. Though he was also barefoot, the jumble of nails and screws didn't appear to bother him.
"She has something and they want it. It's got to be here somewhere. But where?"
The air filled with the pungent fumes of engine lubricant as her dad tipped over the barrel, letting the yellowish grease gurgle and spill out over his mess.
"Dad, put it down!"
She grabbed a hammer off the floor and held it overhead.
"I will hit you, I swear it!"
He finally looked at her with that same haunted madness. This was not her father. This man was not vain and charming and self-indulgent. All the things she'd admired as a child and despised as a teenager. This man was broken. The stream of oil became a light drizzle.
"Dad, put down the barrel. Now."
His lips trembled as his attention shifted away, focused on the small delivery ship not a body's length away from him.
"She loved flying," he murmured. "She loved her ships."
"Dad! Dad!"
Standing, her dad heaved the barrel into the back window of the ship, a hairline fracture cobwebbed out on the glass.
"Not my ship!"
Scarlet dropped the hammer and ran for him, stumbling her way over tools and debris. The glass shattered with the second hit as her dad was already hauling himself through the shards.
"Stop it!"
Scarlet grabbed him around the waist and dragged him out of the ship.
"Leave it alone!"
He thrashed in her hold, his knee catching Scarlet in the side, and they both fell onto the floor. A canister bit into Scarlet's thigh, but all she could think about was tightening her hold on her dad, trying to lock his swinging arms to his side. Blood was out on his hands where he grabbed the broken glass, and a gash in his side was already turning crimson.
"Let me go, Scar! I'm going to find it! I'm going to—"
he cried out as he was lifted away from her. Instinctively, Scarlet clung, still trying to subdue him, until she realized that Wolf was there, dragging her dad to his feet. She let go, panting. One hand went to rub her throbbing hip.
"Let go of me!"
Craning his head, her dad snapped his teeth at the air. Ignoring his struggles, Wolf bound his wrists with one hand and stretched the other out toward Scarlet. No sooner had her palm sunk onto his than her dad's screams renewed.
"He's one of them! One of them!"
Wolf yanked Scarlet to her feet and released her, using both arms to restrain her struggling father. Scarlet almost expected to see foam at the corners of her dad's mouth.
A tattoo scar! It's them! It's them!
She pushed her hair off her face.
I know, Dad. Just calm down. I can explain. You can't take me back. I'm still looking. I need more time. Please, no more. No more.
He dissolved into sobs. Wolf's eyebrows drew together as he peered at the back of her father's drooped head. Then he grabbed a thin chain around his neck and pulled, snapping it. Her dad flinched, and when Wolf released him, sank heavily to the floor. Scarlet gawked at the necklace hanging from Wolf's fist, a small, unfamiliar charm dangling from it. She couldn't remember her father wearing any jewelry, other than the monogamy band that he'd taken off within days of her mother figuring out the ring hadn't served its purpose and leaving him.
Transmitter,
Wolf said, holding the charm up so that its silver sheen blinked in the light. It was no larger than Scarlet's pinky nail.
They've been tracking him and, I would guess, listening in on everything as well.
Scarlet's dad hugged his knees, rocking.
Do you think they're listening now?
Scarlet asked.
Most likely.
A firework exploded in her ribcage, and she launched forward, grabbing Wolf's fist in both hands.
There's nothing here! She screamed at the charm. We're not hiding anything, and you have the wrong woman! You'd better bring my grandmother back, and I swear on the house I was born in, if you hurt one hair, one wrinkle, one freckle on her body, I'm going to hunt every last one of you down and snap your necks like the chickens you are. Do you understand me? Bring her back!
Throat hoarse, she fell back and released Wolf's hand.
Finished?
Trembling with anger, Scarlet nodded. Wolf dropped the transmitter onto the floor, grabbing the hammer, and smashed it with a single, clean strike. Scarlet jumped as metal crunched against the concrete.
Do you think they knew he would come here?
Wolf said, standing.
They left him in our cornfield.
Her father's voice rose between them, dry and empty.
They told me to find it.
Find what? Scarlet asked.
I don't know, they didn't say, just that she's hiding something, something valuable and secret, and they want it.
Wait, you knew? Said Scarlet. You knew all along that you were bugged, and you didn't try to tell me?
Dad, what if I said something or done something that made them suspect me? What if they do come after me next? I didn't have a choice, he said. It was the only way they would let me go. They said I could only have my freedom if I found what your grandmother was hiding, if I found some clue that would help. I had to get out of their scar. You don't know what it was like.
I know they still have her, and I know that you're coward enough to save your own skin and not worried about what's happening to her, or what could happen to me. Scarlet held her breath, waiting for him to deny it, to give some twisted excuse like he'd always had. But he stayed perfectly still, perfectly silent. Her skin flushed with anger.
You're a disgrace to her, to everything she's ever stood for. She would risk her life to protect either one of us. She would risk her life for a stranger if it was the right thing to do. But all you care about is yourself. I can't believe you're her son. I can't believe you're my father.
He raised his haunted eyes to her.
You're wrong, Scarlet. She watched them torture me. Me. And she still kept her secrets.
A spark of defiance flickered over his face.
There's something your grandmother never told us, Scar. And it's put both of us in danger. She's the selfish one.
You don't know anything about her.
No, you don't. You've been idolizing her since you were 4 years old, and it's blinded you to the truth. She's betrayed us both, Scarlet.
Blood pounding against her temples, Scarlet pointed out the door.
Get out. Get off my farm, and never come back. I hope I never see you again.
He paled, the circles like bruises under his eyes. Slowly, he peeled himself off the floor.
You're going to abandon me too? My own daughter and my own mother, both turning against me.
You abandoned us first.
Scarlett realized that in the 5 years since she'd last seen him, she'd come to match her father's height. They stood eye to eye, she burning up on the inside, he frowning as though he wanted to be sorry but couldn't quite grasp the emotion.
Goodbye, Luke.
His jaw flexed.
They'll come for me again, Scarlett, and it will be on your hands. Don't you dare. You're the one who was wearing that transmitter. You're the one who was willing to sell me out.
He held her eyes for a long, slow count, like he was waiting for her to change her mind, waiting for her to welcome him back to the house, back into her life. But all Scarlett could hear was the crunch of the hammer against the transmitter. She thought of the burn marks on his arm and knew he would just as soon give her over for torture, if it would have saved his own skin. Finally, his gaze fell, and without looking at her, without looking at Wolf, her dad shuffled through the debris and out of the hangar. Scarlett's fists settled against her sides. She would have to wait. He would go into the house to collect his shoes. She imagined him rummaging through the kitchen for food before he went, or trying to hunt down some stray liquor bottles. She dared not run the risk of their paths crossing again before he was gone for good. The coward. The traitor. I'll help you. She crossed her arms, protecting her anger against the gentleness of Wolf's voice. She scanned the chaos all around her, the mess that would take weeks to put right.
I don't need your help. I meant, I'll help get your grandmother back.
Wolf ducked away, like he was surprised he'd made the offer. It took a pathetically long time for her thinking to change directions, from the internal rant against her traitorous father to the hefty meaning behind Wolf's words. She blinked up at him and held her breath, imagining his words captured in a bubble that might blow away.
You will?
His head jerked in what could have been a nod.
The wolves are headquartered in Paris. That's probably where they're keeping her. Paris. The word filled her up. A clue. A promise.
She glanced at her ship and its shattered window. Renewed hatred flared for her father, but it deflated quickly. There wasn't time. Not now. Not when she had her first taste of hope in 2 endless weeks.
Paris, she murmured. We can take the train from Toulouse. It's what, 8 hours?
She hated the thought of being without her ship, but even the obnoxiously slow maglev train would be quicker than getting the window replaced.
Someone will have to look after the farm while I'm gone. Maybe Emily after her shift. I'll send her a comm. Then I just need to grab some clothes and...
Scarlett, wait, we can't just rush up there. We need to think this through.
Rush? We can't rush? They've had her for more than 2 weeks. This isn't rushing.
Wolf's gaze darkened, and Scarlett paused, for the first time recognizing his unease.
Look, she said, wetting her tongue. We'll have 8 hours on the train to think up something. But I can't stay here a moment longer. But what if your father is right?
His shoulders stayed stiff.
What if she has hidden something here? What if they come looking for it?
She roughly shook her head.
They can look all they want, but they won't find anything. My dad is wrong. Grand-mère and I don't keep secrets.
Chapter 14.
Your Majesty.
Kai turned away from the window that he'd been staring out half the morning, listening to the drone of the news anchors and military officials reporting on the escape of the most wanted convict in the Eastern Commonwealth. Chairman Hui stood in the doorway, torn beside him. Both looked supremely unhappy. He gulped.
Well?
Hui stepped forward.
They've gotten away.
Kai's pulse hiccuped. He took a tentative step toward his father's desk and gripped the back of the chair.
I've given the order to deploy our reserve fleets immediately. I am confident we'll have the fugitives found and taken into custody by sunset.
With all respect, Chairman, you don't sound particularly confident. Though Hui puffed his chest out, his face took on a tinge of pink.
I am, Your Majesty. We can find them. It's only that... it's complicated by it being a stolen ship. All the tracking equipment has been stripped.
Torn let out an irritated sigh.
The girl has proven herself to be more clever than I would have given her credit for.
Kai dragged his hand through his hair, extinguishing an unexpected spark of pride.
There is also the issue of the girl being lunar, Hui added.
Whoever captures her will just have to be alert, said Kai. They should all be made well aware that she'll no doubt try to turn their minds against them.
There is that too, but not what I was referring to. In the past, we've had difficulty tracking lunar ships. It seems that they've learned how to disable our radar systems. I'm afraid we're not sure how they do it.
Disable our radar systems? Kai glanced at Torin. Did you know about this?
I've heard rumors, said Torin. Your father and I chose to believe that's all they were. Not all my contemporaries agree with me on this matter, said Hui, but I myself am convinced it is the Lunars disabling our equipment. Whether it's through their mental abilities or some other talent, I can't tell. Regardless, Lin Cinder won't get far. We'll have every resource searching for her.
Tempering his internal turmoil, Kai molded his face into stone.
Keep me informed. Of course, Your Majesty. There is one other thing I thought you might want to see. We finished going over our security footage from the prison.
Hui gestured to the inlaid screen in Kai's desk. Rounding his chair, Kai tugged on his long sleeves, suddenly warm, and sat down. A comm from the Council of National Security rotated in the corner. Accept comm. The screen brightened with footage of the prison, all white and glossy walls. It showed a long hallway lined with smooth doors and ID scanners. A prison guard moved into view and gestured at a door. He was followed by a short, old man wearing a gray cap. Kai jerked upward. It was Dr. Erland.
Volume up!
Dr. Erland's familiar voice filtered through the screen.
I am the leading scientist of the Royal Letemosis Research Team, and this girl is my prime test subject. I require blood samples from her before she leaves the planet.
Looking miffed, he reached into a bag and pulled something out. A syringe, but the bag still bulged. That wasn't all that was inside it.
I have my orders, sir, said the guard. You'll have to obtain an official release from the Emperor to be allowed entrance.
Kai frowned as the doctor put the syringe back into the bag, knowing that Dr. Erland hadn't made such a request.
All right, if that's protocol, I understand, said Dr. Erland.
And then he just stood there, serene and patient. After the space of a few heartbeats, Kai glimpsed the doctor's smile.
There, you see, I have obtained the necessary release from the Emperor. You may open the door.
Kai's jaw dropped as, amazingly, the guard turned toward the cell door, swiped his wrist across the scanner, and punched in a code. A green light flashed, and the door opened.
Thank you kindly, said Dr. Erland, passing the guard. I'll ask that you give us a bit of privacy. I won't be but a minute.
The guard complied without argument, shutting the door and meandering in the direction they'd come from, leaving the screen empty. Kai glanced up at Hui.
Has the guard been questioned? Yes, sir, and his statement is that he remembers denying access to the girl, and then the doctor left. He was confounded when we showed him this footage. He claims to not remember any of it. How is that possible?
Hui busied his hands by buttoning his suit jacket.
It appears, Your Majesty, that Dr. Dimitri Erland glamoured the guard into allowing him access to the prisoner's cell.
Hairs prickled beneath his collar. Kai slumped back in his chair.
Glamoured?
You think he's lunar?
That is our theory.
Kai stared up at the ceiling. Cinder, lunar. Dr. Erland, lunar.
Is it a conspiracy?
Torin cleared his throat, as he did whenever Kai mentioned some off-the-wall theory, although it seemed like a perfectly legitimate question to Kai.
We're in the process of investigating all possibilities, said Torin. At least now, we know how she escaped.
We have other video that shows the prisoner glamoring the guard on the next shift, said Hui, and being shown to a new cell. In that footage, she has 2 feet, and a different left hand from the one she entered the prison with.
Kai shoved himself out of his chair.
The bag, he said, pacing toward the windows. Yes, Dr. Erland was bringing her these tools. We must assume with the intention of assisting her escape.
That's why he left. Kai shook his head, wondering how Cinder really knew Dr. Erland. What they'd really been doing all those times she'd come to see him at the hospital. Plotting, conniving, conspiring?
I thought she was just fixing a med droid, he murmured to himself. I didn't even question. Stars, I've been so stupid.
Your Majesty, said Hui, our few resources, not searching for Lin Cinder, have been dedicated to finding Dimitri Erland. He will be arrested as a traitor to the crown.
Please excuse the interruption, said Nancy, the android who had once tutored Kai as a child, but had now taken on the more significant role of personal assistant. The android who had malfunctioned, was it not even 4 weeks ago? And led him to his first meeting with Lin Cinder, back when she was nothing more to him than a renowned mechanic.
Her Majesty Lunar Queen Levana has requested an immediate appoint-
I will not be announced by an android.
Hui and Torin spun around as Queen Levana swooped in and backhanded Nancy across her single blue sensor, eyes flaming. The android no doubt would have toppled onto her back if her stabilizing hydraulics hadn't kicked in just in time to catch her. The queen's usual entourage followed. Sybil Mira, head thaumaturge, whose role in the lunar court seemed to be a cross between a doting lapdog and a gleeful servant who delighted in seeing to Levana's cruelest requests. Kai had once seen her attack and nearly blind an innocent servant at the queen's bidding, without a hint of hesitation. She was followed by another thaumaturge, one rank beneath Sybil, who had dark skin and piercing eyes and no purpose, it seemed to Kai, other than to stand behind his queen and look smug. Sybil's personal guard followed, the blonde man who had held Cinder during the ball when Levana first threatened her life. Even after a month of their being guests in his palace, Kai didn't know his name. A second guard, his hair flaming red, had been the one to jump in between a bullet and Levana at the ball, taking it squarely in the shoulder. It seemed that bullet wounds weren't enough to let one off royal guard duty, though, and the only indication of the wound was the lump of a bandage beneath his uniform.
Your Majesty, Kai said, addressing the queen with, he thought, an admirable lack of contempt. What a pleasant surprise.
One more patronizing comment, and I will have you slice off and nail your own tongue to the palace gate.
Kai blanched. Levana's voice, usually so melodious and sweet, was rigid as steel, and though he'd seen her angry many times before, it had never been enough for her to drop the thin veneer of diplomacy.
Your Majesty, you let her escape! My prisoner!
I assure you, we're doing everything we can—
Amory, silence him!
Kai's tongue fell limp. Eyes widening, he reached a hand to his lips, realizing it wasn't only his tongue, but his throat, his jaw. The muscles had gone useless, which perhaps was better than having his tongue nailed to the palace gate, but still. His gaze darted to the male thaumaturge in his pristine red coat, who grinned charmingly back. Rage flared inside him.
You're doing everything you can? Levana flattened her palms on Kai's desk.
Their glares battled over the net screen that still showed the empty prison hallway, frozen in time.
You're telling me, young Emperor, that you didn't assist her escape? That your intention from the start hasn't been to humiliate me on your soil?
Kai sensed that she wanted him to fall to his knees and silently plead for forgiveness, to promise to move the earth and the heavens to satisfy her. But his anger overwhelmed his fear. With his ability to speak removed, he folded his arms over the back of his chair and waited. From the corner of his eye, he could see Torin and Huey, still as statues but for dark scowls. Sybil Mira, with her hands innocently tucked into her ivory sleeves, must have been holding them at bay with her lunar mind magic. Nancy, the only being in the room that the Lunars couldn't control with mind tricks, was being physically held by the blonde guard, turned so that her sensor and the built-in camera couldn't capture the proceedings. The queen's fingertips whitened against the desk.
You expect me to believe that you didn't encourage this escape? That you had nothing to do with it?
Her expression tightened.
You certainly don't seem too upset about it, Your Majesty.
Bewilderment stirred in Kai's gut, but his face remained neutral. Years of rumors and superstitions circulated in his thoughts. Rumors that Levana knew whenever anyone was talking about her. Anywhere on Luna, even on Earth. But he suspected a much more plausible reason for her uncanny ability to know what she shouldn't know. She'd been spying on him, and his father before. He knew it. He just didn't know how. Realizing that she was waiting for a response, Kai quirked an eyebrow and flourished a hand toward his mouth. Levana seethed and pushed herself back from the desk. She stretched her neck until she was staring down her nose at him.
Speak.
Sensation returned to his tongue, and Kai threw a thankless smile at Amory. He then proceeded to do the most disrespectful thing he could think of. He pulled his chair back from his desk and sat down. Tipping back, he folded his hands over his stomach. Anger sizzled behind Levana's charcoal eyes until she was almost, briefly, unbeautiful.
No, Kai said, I didn't encourage the fugitive to escape or assist her in any way. What reason do I have to believe that after you seemed so enchanted with her at the ball?
His brow twitched.
If you're going to refuse to take my word, why don't you just force a full confession out of me and be done with it? Oh, I could, Your Majesty. I could put any words into that mouth of yours that I wanted to hear. But unfortunately, we are not mind readers, and I am concerned only with the truth.
Then allow me to give it to you, Kai hoped he seemed more indulgent than annoyed. Our preliminary investigation has shown that she used both her lunar and cyborg abilities to escape from her cell, and while she may have had assistance from within the palace, it was done without my knowledge. I'm afraid we were unequipped to keep a prisoner who is both cyborg and lunar. We will, of course, be working on strengthening our prison system for the future. In the meantime, we are doing everything in our power to track down the fugitive and apprehend her. I made a bargain with you, Your Majesty, and I do intend to keep my end.
You've already failed your end of the bargain, she spat.
But then her face softened.
Young Emperor, I certainly hope you didn't fancy yourself in love with this girl.
Kai's grip tightened until his knuckles screamed.
Any feelings I may have imagined for Lynn Cinder were clearly nothing more than a lunar trick.
Clearly, I am glad you recognize that. Levana folded her own hands demurely before her. I am done with this charade, and am returning to Luna immediately.
You have 3 days to find the girl and deliver her to me. If you fail, I will send my own army to find her, and they will tear apart every spaceship, every docking station, and every home on this pathetic planet until she is found.
White spots flashed in Kai's vision, and he shoved himself back to his feet.
Why don't you just say what you mean? You've been wanting a reason to invade Earth for 10 years, and now you're using this one escaped lunar, this nobody, to accomplish it.
The corners of Lavanna's lips tilted.
You seem to misunderstand my motives, so I will say precisely what I mean. I will someday rule the Commonwealth, and it is your decision whether that is to be through a war or through a peaceful and diplomatic marriage union. But this has nothing to do with war and politics. I want this girl. Or I want her corpse. I will burn your country to the ground, looking for her if I must.
Lavanna pulled away from the desk and drifted out of the office, her entourage falling in step behind her with neither expression nor comment. When they had gone, Hui and Torin each melted in front of Kai, looking like they hadn't taken a breath since the queen's entrance. And perhaps they hadn't. Kai didn't know what Sybil had been doing to them, but he could guess it hadn't been comfortable. Nancy swiveled on her treads.
I am so sorry, Your Majesty. I never would have given her access, but the door was already open.
Kai silenced her with a wave.
Yes, how coincidental that she chose the one time when the door wasn't shut and coded to barge in here, isn't it?
Nancy's processor whirred, no doubt running the odds. Kai rubbed one hand down his face.
It doesn't matter. Everyone out, please.
Nancy vanished out the door, but Hui and Torin lingered.
Your Majesty, Hui said, with all due respect, I need your permission.
Yes, fine. Whatever you need to do, just, I need a moment. Please.
Hui clicked his heels.
Of course, Your Majesty.
Though Torin looked more apt to argue, he didn't, and soon the door was hissing behind them both. With a click of the latch, Kai let himself crumble into his chair. His entire body was shaking. It was suddenly so clear that he wasn't ready for this. He wasn't strong enough or smart enough to fill his father's shoes. He couldn't even keep Lavanna out of his own office. How was he going to protect an entire country from her? An entire planet? Spinning his chair around, he raked his hands back through his hair. His attention swept over the city below, but was soon pulled up to the glaring blue sky, cloudless. Somewhere beyond it was the moon and the stars and tens of thousands of cargo ships, passenger ships, military ships, delivery ships, vying for space beyond the ozone. And Cinder was in one of them. He couldn't help it, but a part of him, maybe a large part of him, hoped Cinder would just disappear, like a fading comet's tail, just to spite the queen, to keep from her this one thing she so desperately wanted. It was only her vanity, after all, that had set off this tirade, because Cinder had made that one foolish comment at the ball, suggesting that Lavanna wasn't beautiful after all. Kai massaged his temple, knowing that he had to give up these thoughts. Cinder had to be found, and soon, before millions were murdered in her place. It was all politics now. Pros and cons, give and take, trades and agreements. Cinder had to be found. Lavanna had to be appeased. Kai had to stop acting cheated and indignant and start acting like an emperor. Whatever he'd once felt for Cinder, or thought he'd felt for her, was over. Chapter 15. Cinder turned off the shower and propped herself against the fiberglass wall while the nozzle dripped onto her head. She would have liked to stay in longer, but was worried about using up the water supply, and judging from the half-hour shower Thorne had taken, she clearly couldn't rely on him for conservation. Nevertheless, she was clean. The smell of sewage was gone, the salty sweat rinsed away. Stepping out of the communal shower, she rubbed her hair with a starchy towel, then spent a moment drying all the crevices and joints of her prosthetics to protect against rust. It was habit, even though her new limbs already had a protective coating. Dr. Erland, it seemed, hadn't skimped on anything. Her soiled prison uniform was balled in a corner on the tiled floor. She'd found a discarded military uniform in the crew quarters, oversized charcoal gray pants that had to be belted in at her waist, and a plain white undershirt, which wasn't much different from the cargos and t-shirts she was used to, back before she'd become a fugitive of the law. All that was missing were her ever-present gloves. She felt naked without them. She threw the towel and prison uniform into the laundry chute and unlatched the shower room door. The thin corridor revealed an open doorway to the galley on her right, and the cargo bay packed full with plastic crates to her left. "Home, sweet home," she murmured, wringing droplets from her hair as she ambled toward the cargo bay. There was no sign of the so-called captain. Only the faint running lights along the floor were on, and the darkness and the silence and the knowledge of all the empty space around the ship, stretching out for eternity, gave Cinder the peculiar sensation that she was a phantom haunting a shipwreck. She picked her way through the obstacle course of storage bins and sank into the pilot's seat in the cockpit. Through the window, she could see Earth, the shores of the American Republic, and most of the African Union visible beneath the swirling cloud cover. And beyond it, stars, so many stars, swirling and misting into countless galaxies. They were both beautiful and terrifying, billions of light years away, and yet, seeming so bright and close, it was almost suffocating. All Cinder had ever wanted was freedom. Freedom from her stepmother and her overbearing rules. Freedom from a life of constant work with nothing to show for it. Freedom from the sneers and hateful words of strangers who didn't trust the cyborg girl who was too strong and too smart and too freakishly good with machines to ever be normal. Now she had her freedom, but it wasn't anything like she'd envisioned. Sighing, Cinder pulled her left foot onto her knee, shoved up her pant leg, and opened the hollow compartment inside her calf. The compartment had been searched and emptied when she had been admitted into prison. Just one more invasion. But the most valuable contents had been ignored. No doubt the guard performing her search had thought the chips nestled into the wiring were a part of Cinder's own programming. 3 chips. She plucked them out, one by one, laying them out on the arm of her chair. There was the shimmering white DCOM chip. It was a lunar chip, made from some material Cinder hadn't seen before. Lavanna had ordered it to be installed in Nancy, Kai's android, and used it to gather confidential information. The girl who had programmed the chip, supposedly the Queen's personal programmer, had later used it to contact Cinder and tell her that Lavanna was planning to marry Kai, and then kill him and use the power of the Eastern Commonwealth to invade the rest of the Earthen Union. It was this information that had sent Cinder running to the ball only a few short days ago, what seemed like a lifetime ago. She couldn't regret it. She knew she would do it all over again, despite what a mess her life had become since that single rash decision. Then there was Iko's personality chip. It was the largest and most abused of the 3. One side showed a distinct green